Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. Gaia.com. G-A-I-A.com. Boo, ha, 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 ha. Wished I had a creepy Halloween voice, but I don't, folks. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. It's me, Cam, as always, and chilling with me over here. No chocolate on his fingers as of just yet. Is the filio, Kyle Filson. Brud, no chocolate just yet? Nothing?
Not yet. Holding out just a little bit longer before the ravenous consumption of chocolate begins. Yep. No, I haven't started yet.
I wished I had a good creepy voice, like the you know?
Oh, like Vincent Price or
something?
Yeah, that's what, man.
I wished I had a cool voice like that.
If you did, I mean, there's lots of voiceover work. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize, they don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, me and you have done some voiceover work before for
that's
other
true.
Stuff.
That is true.
And it was pretty fun. It's pretty interesting because I remember when we were first doing it, they were like, well, you know, do it like this. I'm like, look, we've never done it. They're like, you've never done it before?
We have no idea what it is.
Yeah. No.
Surprisingly enough, no, we have not. Yeah. Because we don't have good radio voices or television faces. So I really don't know what we're doing here.
Double loss.
Yeah,
I'm surprised anybody wants to listen to us, to be honest.
Yeah. So y'all are all special to us. So thank you so very much.
Yeah.
Hey, I don't know if your Halloween involves this, but everybody's normally has, you know, when you're an adult Halloweener, you like to have a, is that Halloweener? Is that a real? So you like to have a drink or two. I know I like beer. All of you have turned out. We've gotten tons of emails for all
the local breweries.
Right? Thank you. And all the messages. Thank you. There's so much stuff Kyle and I are going to have to go through and do some emails. And we got a lot to do. And on that note, I found something here that I think is worth talking about. Now, this comes from the NPR. Apparently, about 2,500 years ago, it says that this brew was buried with the dead. And a certain brewery has revived it. A 2,500-year-old alcoholic beverage. And we had talked about some of this stuff in the past, but apparently there's an Iron Age burial plot over in what is today is in Germany. And an archaeologist and anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a few others uncovered this cauldron. And in that cauldron, you know, they said they looked around and it was buried with the deceased. But in that cauldron was the remains of a brew. And so they were like, huh, well, you know, what do we got going on here? What are we going to figure out here on this whole thing? So they start going through this stuff, right? They've got to find out what this is. They break it down, comes to find out that I'll tell you exactly what was in it.
Okay. So all you now, home brewers, get out your pens.
All your home brewers. Basically, it was a, they call it a braggot. Apparently it says the alcohol vessel is believed to be a braggot. Now, this is Chad Sheridan. He's a cellar master at Lakefront Brewery. And he says a braggot is a blend of barley and honey as the two sugar ingredients to create this beverage. So Sheridan says he was pulled into the project because of his background in home brewing meads and braggots. Says besides yeast, the brew really only contains four ingredients.
Okay.
Get your pencils out. Barley, honey, mint, and meadow sweet. Said it took 7 hours to make the brew and another 2 weeks to let it ferment. So they made it. They go through, they make it, they get all this stuff. He says, I got to sip the final product. The result was smooth and pleasant, almost like a dry port, but with a minty herbal tinge to it. And it also packed an alcoholic kick. Yeah.
That's cool.
Isn't it crazy?
Now, are they going to bottle this stuff?
Well, it says, he goes, alas, you won't find this ancient recipe on beer store shelves anytime soon. Said it's certainly drinkable and has a very cool taste, but I don't think people would be interested in purchasing it as a drink. Now, this is Chris Ranson at Lakefront Brewery. He said, but it was a fun experiment to do. Now, Arnold says it's actually quite fortuitous that they were able to recreate this recipe. He says, luckily for us, they didn't just send people off to the afterlife with swords and spears, but they sent them off with this burial. They call it the BYOB afterlife is what they're doing. Right now, I can't find where they're saying that they, you know, they want to do it, but it says that this recreated brew is hopefully the first attempt of many under this whole thing. So they're going to, I guess they found some more of these in the past.
Well, I've read before in other articles that they found some ancient recipes for not only beer, but bread mm-hmm. and a few other things, and that these people have been out there. There's these small groups where they've been recreating this stuff. So that's pretty neat. But who knows, that recipe, that might have been like that guy's recipe.
Yes.
Like maybe he was two broods like us, and we were home brewing, and that was our, you know, Expanded Perspectives brew or Mothman brew or whatever. And that was unique to him. So that's pretty cool that thousands of years later, they're able to recreate what he was drinking at that time. Also, you got to remember, at that time, they were limited as far as the ingredients compared to what we have now, you know, so.
Well, and it was also something that they did almost as a necessity, where we do it as a hobby. So people can explore more into the ingredients, explore more into the yeasts and things like that. I really wish that they would do it, because what's cool is Bettina Arnold. Bettina Arnold is the archaeologist lady that found this cauldron. She's the one that got a hold of the brewery, of Lakefront Brewery, teamed up with the one out of Milwaukee to make all this. And I understand what they're saying, is it's probably an acquired taste. It's not something you could mass produce.
Right.
But it was something, you know, I would love to try it. I would love for them, maybe a small batch, you know what I mean? Make a small batch of it, let it set up. Maybe you only make a seasonal batch of this stuff every year, and you only make a couple hundred gallons, and that's it. When it's gone, it's gone. You do it again next year, something like that. Where that way you're not investing a whole lot into it. But it's still fun, and I was thinking, how awesome would that be? Because I think you and I actually talked about a Chinese beer recipe we talked about that was like 5,000 years old, something along those lines.
I remember us talking. I don't remember what part of the world it was from, but I do remember that.
I want to say that's what it was from earlier, but because it was the beer making in China, the central plains of China is what I remember. So anyway, it's just one of those things that you look back and you find all these old recipes. Sooner or later, somebody's going to put together a little book on all the recipes that were, say, over 500 years old or over 1,000-year-old recipes.
Yeah.
And then it'll have beer and bread and, like you're talking about, everything in it. But anyway, I thought it was fun.
That is cool. Well, sticking with archaeology, check this out. This comes from Ancient Origins. A remarkable 7,000-year-old megalithic site that served as an astronomical observatory has recently been found in Maduma Village in Telangana, India. The discovery has been hailed as one of the most significant archaeological findings in India during the last few decades. According to Times of India, a team of archaeologists described it as the only megalithic site in India where a depiction of a star constellation has been identified. The ancient observatory dates to around 5000 BC, and the researchers believe that it is the earliest astronomical observatory discovered in India and perhaps even the whole of southern Asia. The site consists of 80 huge menhirs. And a menhir is a standing stone, which are 3.5 to 4 meters tall. There also is about 2,000 alignment stones, which are 30 to 60 centimeters tall. Now, according to these experts, no other excavation site in India has so many menhirs concentrated in such a small area. The maximum concentration of menhirs is located in the central portion of this monument. Now, one of the surprising details discovered at the site is the depiction of the constellation known as Ursa Major, which is formed from small cup-sized pits carved into the standing stone. The group of about 30 cup marks were arranged in the same shape in which Ursa Major can be observed in the night sky with the naked eye. The carving depicts not only the prominent seven stars, but also some peripheral stars. Researchers believe that the site holds many secrets, and the next planned research will take place in December, which is going to be led by an archaeologist from Korea. So very cool. So once again, they're discovering how the ancients had this, you know, vast knowledge of the heavens and the mm-hmm. stars and the constellations. And here it is, another site, a megalithic site dedicated to that, recreating this constellation of Ursa Major. So that's really cool. I love it when they find these. And it's surprising that in 2016 that they're still able to find these. It means how many times are there people just walking around and you're walking right through a megalithic site, you just don't pay any attention. You're like, oh, I just thought it was a stone standing there.
I wonder.
How many more are there? How many are under lakes? How many are under the ocean? I mean, who knows?
Well, I was watching a thing on Netflix just the other day, and it was showing some stuff in Cambodia, and it was basically all about the animals in the area there, and it was showing Angkor Wat. And I was just thinking about all the stuff that they had scanned when we had covered that they had found in the jungles of all these other, you know, megalithic sites and all the stuff that the jungles had overgrown. And that's what it always makes me think of, not just in the jungles, but it also makes me think about, like in the deserts, that the sand is overtaken, that we can't see down maybe into. And I always wonder, like what you're talking about, is how many other megalithic sites and structures are on this planet that we haven't even laid eyes on yet that may actually tell a more broad or even a more precise story than what we know now.
Yeah, and what's crazy is Angkor Wat wasn't even discovered until 1860. And this thing is twice as large as the city of Manhattan.
Could you imagine being the first person to find that and been like, what have I gotten into?
I know you've never been in Manhattan, but it's an island and it's, you know, basically like 2 miles wide and I think 12 miles long or something. So imagine something twice that size that no one even knew was there until 1860.
Sitting out in a jungle.
Except
for the natives. The natives, well, of course, area knew it was there. Yeah. As far as outside of that area,
we had
no idea it was even there. Something that they didn't deem necessary to talk about because it was just always there.
If you train kickboxing like Tong Po and Jean-Claude Van Damme did, remember in Kickboxer?
Exactly, yeah.
You can fight with the ancients, you can spar with the ancients.
You need to go there.
And it'll make you very strong. There's usually a hawk watching you.
It has to be, yeah, you're right. You have to have a bow staff. You have to have a guy that makes you carry a lot of water. If you notice, a lot of the really good fighters, they carry a lot of water.
I've heard that.
And they don't spill it.
Yeah, I've heard that Nick Diaz implements the same thing. His brother Nate ties a stake to his legs and lets the dog chase him and stuff.
I heard they have a bow staff with like buckets of water on either end. I heard that.
Yeah.
I heard that's the best. I heard that's how all the Anderson Silva, all the great fighters, they trained that way.
Yep.
Well, during the Elite Show, I had covered something a little while about a sighting off of Cryptozoology News, and I found another one here from Lon's site here at Phantoms and Monsters that happened in the Bay Area, and I want you to get a load of this. It says, on or about September 3rd of 2008, on a clear sunny day around 11 a.m., I was driving north on Highway 680 between Fremont and Pleasanton, California, and just at the Highway 84 off-ramp, I looked up when something large caught my eye, and what I saw was a small pterosaur flying about 30 foot above my car. Now, you talk about driver distraction. It flew directly over me, perpendicular to my direction. It says, heading east towards Livermore. The reason I can estimate its distance from me is that it appeared to be about 10 foot above the top of the traffic cam located at the Highway 680-84 junction, which I was approaching at the moment. The creature looked very similar to the paintings of the Ropan of Indonesia. I would estimate it had about a 3 to 5 foot wingspan. It was light tan, all leathery skin, and the most astonishing thing was that it had no feathers. I could see the wrinkles and texture of its skin moving over its bones as it flew. The eyes were very large, round eyes, and it appeared to be young, or at least I had the impression because of its size and some of its features, like the tail and the bump on the back of its head, were not as developed as those depicted of adult Ropan or pterosaur. I thought it probably flew at night because of the size of its eyes, which were perfectly round and huge, much, much larger than an owl's, for example. The eyes probably took up 40% of its cranial facial area. As my rational mind was striving to take all this in, I wondered why it was flying in daylight, though it did not seem to be alarmed by anything. The wings were triangular, slightly rounded at the tips, but I did not see any hands attached to the wings as these creatures are sometimes portrayed. The back of its triangular-shaped head came to a rounded point, jutting out a few inches. Its tail was not much more than a pointed stump. It had a fairly broad triangular-shaped beak that was longer than the bump at the back of its head, perhaps about 10 or 12 inches. Now again, I was surprised at the breadth of its beak because it differed from drawings I've seen in books. But this was no pelican, bat, or anything else I've ever seen flying through the sky. It had no feathers, and as it flew, its clawed feet hung down slightly from its body, positioned more towards the middle of the underside. They were not positioned at the back of the body under the tail, nor were they attached to the wings. Its large claws were slightly curled and facing backwards. I thought it looked a little bit clumsy as it flew, in that its feet and legs were not tucked up tight against the body during the flight like birds. They were just kind of dangling down, and I could remember seeing three visible toes. I was so shocked, but also felt awe and excitement, and I just wanted to pull over and watch it. But alas, I had to force myself to take my eyes off of it and mind the driving. It would have been a dangerous place to stop on the busy freeway, let alone to get out of the car, and by the time I could have pulled over, the hills would have blocked the view in the direction it was flying, and, of course, it would have been far away by then. I witnessed this creature for 6 to 8 seconds before I had to tear my gaze away, but that was enough time to absolutely know I was looking at something very, very strange, something I'd only seen in books about dinosaurs. I have a keen interest and curiosity about the nature and the nature of reality, cryptozoology, metaphysics, and spirituality. Some would consider me a good observer. This experience felt like a privilege to have been a witness to a secret aspect of our natural world. Perhaps I somehow briefly interfaced with another dimension. But it was a real and third dimensional as any other animal. I told a couple of family members about it, and most of them do not believe me. But I know what I saw. It's exciting and validating to read that more sightings of similar creatures are emerging in many locations. Sincerely, Chris. Now, Lon talks about getting this sent to him, this whole thing. I cannot imagine even seeing something like that, but it's something you and I have discussed before. But also, I heard another a fella on, it was Joe's podcast, when they were talking, the guy that's the anthropologist or what, and was talking about all of this, and he said that they do believe that some dinosaurs had feathers, but not all of them.
Yes,
I've read similar. We've talked about it, as he said he even believes that some of the species, from what they found, of pterosaurs, of flying, some of them had feathers, but not all of them. So it's not like we could dismiss, like we've talked in the past as well, a lot of them say they all had feathers. So what are people seeing if they all had feathers? My question is, how come they're not seeing the feathered dinosaur, the same shape as that, but with feathers? Everybody only sees these leathery-skinned dinosaurs, much like
what books depicted exactly. As they were growing up. Yeah, yeah, it is kind of suspect, right?
Well, it just makes me wonder, is that what you see, or is that what you project? Is there something there, and you're projecting that on it?
Yeah, that could be it, right? It's in your mind that's creating that image, right? Like, it's a hallucination almost.
It almost seems that way. But also, I mean, even in the last account, people see it so vividly, so clearly, that it's hard. Now, look, 6 or 8 seconds isn't very long unless you've been forced underwater for 6 or 8 seconds, or you're almost in a car wreck for 6 or 8 seconds, or you hold your hand over a fire for 6 or 8 seconds. Then it seems like a lot longer.
Yeah,
so
right.
There is, if it was to catch your gaze, just right now, folks, if you're listening to this, just quickly, of course, not if you're driving, you know, but if you're sitting at your desk or whatever you're doing, stop what you're doing, glance over at something, and just try to count to yourself 1-1,000, 2-1,000, all the way up to 8, and try to take in as much detail as that. And you'll see that 8 seconds is a pretty good time if you're focused on nothing but what you're looking at.
Ask any bull rider.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. But anyhow, man, I just thought that was a cool sighting, and it went kind of with last week's, and it's, I would like to see something like this. This is something I think I could probably handle with not freaking out.
Right. Well, check this out. School evacuated after a rock on display in classroom was actually radioactive uranium. Right. It says pupils at a school in Austria were evacuated because a rock they had on display was giving off radiation.
Awesome.
The rock turned out to be a lump of uranium.
Do you smell what the rock is cooking? That's what it's cooking.
The metallic element that is used to produce atomic bombs. Alarmingly, the uranium was giving off thousands of millisieverts of radiation into the missionaries of the Sacred Heart School in Salzburg. A lot higher than what is given off naturally. Fortunately, the rock was identified when an anti-nuclear campaigner, Thomas Neff, came to the science lab to give a speech. And then he was like,
what the hell is that?
You know what you got right there? That's uranium. And it says, during an experiment with a watch containing radium, Neff began to measure levels of radiation in the room using his own Geiger counter and realized that there was 20 times the typical amount of radiation in that room. And it was when he approached the rocks that the reading went through the roof, shooting up to 102,000 counts per minute, far higher than the 60 counts expected in a regular reading.
Oh, that's so awesome.
102,000 counts per minute compared to 60. Neff alerted the school and the pupils. They were all evacuated, and while the rock was recovered and placed into safe storage. Following the discovery, more schools in Salzburg were found to have uranium lumps on display in their classrooms, and they were all removed. A radiological laboratory in Austria said this radioactive screening and the risk assessment show a basic risk potential in Salzburg schools in case of improper storage. Now, look, I'm no professor.
No, you're kidding.
But I will have to say, you might be a little bit more careful on who you're hiring in the science department of these schools.
If they're like, I don't know what this is, but it looks awesome.
What kind of science teacher doesn't know that that's uranium? I mean, not that I would know, but I'm no scientist. So they've been sitting there irradiating kids.
How long?
I don't know. It never says how long those rocks have been on display.
I just like the fact that every time you say The Rock, it makes me start thinking of Dwayne Johnson. Every time you say it, I'm like, The Rock is in safekeeping now. Like, what? What is going on?
Yeah, so the children of the Sacred Heart School there in Salzburg, as well as some other schools in that neighborhood, they've all been getting irradiated with massive doses of radiation.
They don't have any hair, and they're going to have a real short life. But other than that, I'm sure they really know a lot about science. If, like you said, whoever's teaching them needs to, might want to have their certificate pulled. You might need to go back on that.
You're definitely not a geologist. Right?
Can you imagine the guy that saw that come in there? He's like,
he was there to give a speech.
Why is my device acting up? What the hell is in that box? And you walk over there.
Oh,
like,
this is our rock I found when I was fishing.
Yeah, you got to get out of here.
That's uranium, sir.
Right. What a moron. Yeah, that is awesome. I love that. That's. I feel bad for the kids, but it just shows you right now that just idiots are everywhere. I mean, you play, like we say, you play stupid games, you get stupid prizes.
Mm.
Folks, we're going to jump into break right quick. And when we get on the other side, I had covered a little bit of the darkness on the Elite Show. And I said I would carry that over. Now, this takes place here in Texas. It's a little darkness, and it's going to be a little graphic. And like I did on the Elite Show, I'm going to warn a few of y'all. If you're going to have you got a heartstring, it's going to need to be tugged. This is going to do it. And it's also a little graphic and a little rough. So when we get back, I'm going to get into the killing fields here in Texas. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. I discussed some on the Elite Show last week, the uneasiness that we all feel around certain people. It's like a deep-seated warning bell in our DNA, and it's there for our ultimate protection. It's truly a shame that we even need this, because there's no more dangerous, untrustworthy, and sinister creature on this planet than a human being. With that statement, I'm going to introduce you to the story of the Texas killing fields today. Imagine a place of rugged scrub brush, sawgrass, immense heat in the summers, massive humidity, mosquitoes, wild hogs, coyotes, pretty much all the worst parts of a nightmare if you were left in the outdoors. Well, picture that, but it's nestled just out of sight of an interstate, among uninhabited oil fields, and very easy access if you know where it's at. This place I'm describing isn't some perfect movie set where the antagonist takes their victims and dumps them out of view of prying eyes, then proceeds to go undetected for years while still committing these same crimes. No, the place I'm describing is real. And the kicker, though, is that everything else I just said, well, it really happened. You see, there's a place just outside of Houston, Texas, that this very thing took place. And it gripped the heart of the region in fear. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with Houston, just think about this. It's the most populous city in Texas, and it's the fourth most populous city in the United States. A few years ago, population was estimated at 2.2 million. It had a land area covering of just Houston of almost 600 square miles. Now, Houston became the home of the Texas Medical Center. This is the world's largest concentration of healthcare and research institutions. And, of course, NASA's Johnson Space Center, where the Mission Control Center is located, which is where the city gets its nickname, Space City. Houston is the most diverse city in Texas, and it's even been described as the most diverse in the United States. It is home to many cultural institutions and exhibits, and their museum district is so popular, it gets more than 7 million visitors a year. It is here, about a mile off Interstate 45, bordering the Calder Oil Field and League City, just between Galveston and Houston, that our story picks up in 1971. This particular stretch of the interstate is often referred to as the Highway of Hell due to the massive amount of traffic accidents that occur here. It is this remote and desolate area that since the 70s, the bodies of over 30 girls and young women have been found. Most of these murders still unsolved. Many of the bodies not even properly identified. And even more who have gone mysteriously missing in this area, never to be seen again. On June 17th, 1971, 13-year-old Colette Wilson, whom was really excited about spending time with her friends all summer and getting to swim, vanished into thin air after being dropped off at a bus stop after her school band practice. Her disappearance was treated like a missing persons case, and it wasn't until 5 months later and 40 miles away that her small little body would be found. Her wrists and ankles bound, she'd been sexually assaulted and then killed with a single gunshot to the head. Her sister Alice was interviewed a few years ago. She was quoted saying that, "I sometimes wonder what it would be like if Colette hadn't died. She'd have her own children now." Alice even believes that her sister's death drove their father to an early grave at the age of 42. It was just 2 weeks after Colette went missing that on July 1st, 1971, 14-year-old Brenda Jones went missing. She was a kind and thoughtful young girl. She was very excited about the upcoming fireworks shows and was in such a great mood and wanted to share it that she decided to walk down to the Galveston General Hospital right off of I-45 to visit a sick relative. She vanished that day, but was found the next. Yeah, she was found, floating in Galveston Bay. Some clothing stuffed into her mouth. She, too, was dead of a head wound. Gloria Gonzalez, 19 at the time, disappeared on October 28th, 1971, from very near her home there in Houston. Several days later, her body was found, less than 35 yards from where Colette's body had been found. Before 1971 was over, three more girls would be dead. Allison Craven, 12 years old at the time, disappeared November 9th. Her body was found 4 months later. Debbie Ackerman, 15, and her friend Maria Johnson, 15, went to the mall on November 11th. Their bodies were found floating in the water 2 days later, both shot in the back of the head, and both their hands and feet tied together. Kimberly Pritchford, 16, and Suzanne Bowers, 12, would also be victims of this monster. The horrific murders would continue throughout the 70s until a total of 11 teenage and adolescent girls were dead and very unceremoniously dumped in this area. The 11 murders from the 1970s would mostly go unsolved, with only one conviction in relation to any of them. A Mr. Michael Lloyd Self, who was believed to have killed a girl named Sharon Shaw in 1971. But many involved in this case have long thought that he may not have actually done it based on some very weak evidence. But in 1996, a fellow by the name of Edward Harold Bell, who, oddly enough at the time, was serving a sentence for an unrelated murder, claimed in a letter that he'd written to police that he had murdered those 11 girls in Galveston County back in the 70s. He even included Collette Wilson. Yet, there would never be enough evidence to solidly link him to these crimes. The 1980s opened the door to a new decade and of brutal horror also in these killing fields. It started off with the discovery of the body of 12-year-old Brooks Bracewell and her friend, 14-year-old Georgia Gear, both whom had gone missing while visiting a local convenience store. And another killing that had ties to that convenience store was 23-year-old Heidi Villarreal Fay. She would disappear on October 10th in 1983. See, she'd been there using the payphone. Her body was discovered when a dog dug up the rotting corpse and carried the skull to a nearby house, where they left it at the feet of a toddler. Now, more killings and mysterious disappearances would follow throughout the 80s, and these victims were either brutally beaten, shot, or strangled. One of the most famous killing field murders of this era was that of Miss Laura Miller, 16-year-old, who vanished on September 10th of 1984. Also, in front of that very convenience store after making a call home. Her body would be discovered in a secluded oil field on February 3rd of 1986. Like any parent that would have this happen to them, it destroys your soul and you become an empty shell, knowing that you were helpless when your child needed you the most. Knowing, as a father, your baby girl, in her last terrible moments on this planet, was crying out to you, her first hero, and the only man she knew for sure would give her safety, you. Only she had those cries go unanswered. That thought would haunt you for the rest of your days. And that's exactly what consumed Tim Miller. Laura's father, Tim, took that pain and that rage and devoted himself to finding his daughter's killer. Totally frustrated by the lack of progress made by the police and with the lack of information sharing between these jurisdictions was still a major hurdle to solve this case. And as well as the fact that the law enforcement officials were telling him that it was simply a runaway case. Tim Miller was quoted saying, "We've got no suspects, no closure, and we've still got a serial killer walking around someplace." When asked how he was dealing with this, he started wiping tears from his face, quoted saying, "It's been a living hell." Tim Miller was interviewed in Texas Monthly. A few things he found out about Tim. He was a building contractor at the time and was on the controls of a large backhoe, digging in this fielded area, looking for more bodies. There were dozens of search dogs in this area. They were trained to detect the smell of decomposing human flesh. Even some of the workers that worked for Tim were there, on hand to help. As they dug, he looked and looked. One of the men that worked for him even brought his 13-year-old son. And Miller said, "You see those high weeds? That's where we need to dig." You see, Tim Miller had set his sights on a potential suspect in the form of a retired NASA engineer whom had actually worked on the Saturn rocket. This fella's name? Robert Abel. See, Robert had been leasing the land on the periphery, on that area where Laura's body had been found. And Tim's suspicion fell on him when there were some conversations with some of Robert's family members and some of the locals, and they had suggested that Mr. Abel had a very violent side and was a dark individual, and that he was even prone to abusing women and beating his own horses. Well, with that, Mr. Miller became convinced that Robert Abel was his daughter's killer, and he took to following him around and harassing him. More or less, if you will, stalking this man. And then he got law enforcement involved in it also. There were detectives in the area, and even the FBI started profiling Abel, and they found him to be a serial sexual offender. But there was many other additional traits that they believed was often present in serial killers. Well, when all this kind of got let loose, Mr. Abel was treated like a pariah. People were avoiding him at all costs. Many would cross the street when they saw him coming. People would drive down the road and see him walking and scream from their car windows, "You're the killer." At one point, hundreds of people, including Mr. Tim Miller, converged upon Robert Abel's property looking for dead bodies that they thought had been stashed there. They found nothing. Nevertheless, Mr. Miller became absolutely convinced that Abel was the killer. Yet after the police and the FBI were finished with numerous in-depth interrogations with Robert and eyewitnesses, and they even did meticulous searches of his home looking for any clue or any trace of evidence that would link him to the killing of Laura, none was found, and he was never charged for any crime. Tim was quoted saying, "There are many days when I think about driving over there, putting a gun to his head, and pulling the trigger. And when I'm near him, I feel like I'm in the presence of evil." Not a single shred of physical evidence has ever been found linking him to the four women found dumped in that oil field. No evidence has ever been uncovered by any police department that connect him to any of the murders that were investigated, and there was no witness that could place him with any of the teenagers or the women before they were dead. He's also never been arrested for any crime, nor is there any known record of a criminal complaint ever filed against him. Robert Abel has been quoted saying this, "My life has been destroyed, my reputation ruined. I didn't kill any of those girls. I wouldn't know how to kill." Funny that a guilty man would say the same thing to cover his actions. Miller himself would eventually lose interest in pursuing Robert Abel as a suspect, and it's said that even at one point he apologized to the man, more or less, for ruining his life. But in July of 2005, Robert Abel drove his golf cart onto the train tracks as a train approached, ending his life. From a local paper, it says this, I quote, "He died in Belleville under mysterious circumstances at his ranch as he was hit by an oncoming train last Thursday morning while driving his oversized golf cart or small utility vehicle. There were no mechanical problems with the vehicle and no suicide note. However, the train, very easy to see and hear for miles, and it actually ran on a regular schedule." Now, oddly enough, criminal profiler Mr. John White believes the killer is a white male between the ages of 55 and 60. White's quoted saying this, "He's big and he's strong. He's an opportunist who picks girls using payphones at convenience stores. This murderer grabs and snatches or tricks them." Mr. White went on to add that the killer is above normal intelligence and who drives a dark-colored pickup. He was quoted saying, "Two of the most gruesome mutilation murders where the girls were decapitated or their hands cut off were located in almost the exact same spot, 26 years apart. He beats them, then tortures them, and for almost 40 years, he's gotten away with murder." Crystal Jean Baker was 13 at the time she disappeared, March 15, 1996. She's a very pretty girl, and she was last seen using a payphone at a Texas City convenience store. Several hours later, a couple of fishermen found her. Her body, sexually ravaged, she'd been beaten and strangled to death. I say she looked very pretty because she looked just like her great aunt, Miss Norma Jean Baker. Most of you know her as Marilyn Monroe. Crystal's mother remains extremely troubled, quoted saying, "Someone is doing this when we least expect it, and enjoying getting away with it right under our noses. This could happen to anyone's child. Every time I see kids using that same payphone, I just shudder. There's a crazy man out there who has no heart. I can't understand why anyone would deliberately want to hurt my baby." Well, in April of 1997, this monster struck again. This time, the victim was Laura Kate Smitner, age 12. She was an aspiring little ballerina, and she had gone for a jog at just 12 years of age, wanting to stay in shape for her dancing. At this time, she vanished. 17 days later, her decapitated, mostly nude and decomposing body was found on the edge of a pond near I-45 in Friendswood, south of Houston, by a father and son walking their dogs. She was wearing one sock and a ring. Laura Kate's father, Bob, believes that the killer is a sadistic genius. He's quoted saying, "These girls weren't stupid. Not just any stranger could beckon them into a car." Now, one of the most well-known of these cases centers around the mysterious disappearance of a 17-year-old named Miss Jessica Kane. She disappeared August 17, 1997. They found her abandoned pickup on the side of I-45, but she was never located, despite a massive investigation. To this day, her fate remains unknown. Another one of the unsolved mysteries of the Killing Fields. Although it's strongly believed in the circles that she was murdered, just like the similar cases of the time. There was a detective who worked Jessica's case and a few other cases of the Killing Fields. His name is Brian. And he expressed his frustration at the lack of progress made and his frustration also involving the difficulties in solving these cases. And he's quoted saying, "What do you have? You have a car beside the road. That's it. That's your crime scene. Frustrating beyond belief. I mean, how do you find out who was on the road in the middle of the night? You don't. You had Jessica Kane with just the vehicle beside the road. Was it a policeman? I mean, was it one of us? Was it a wannabe policeman, you know, like a volunteer fireman? I mean, somebody we are close with, somebody we drink coffee with, and you just don't know." The killings and disappearances in the area would continue all the way up into the year 2000. Todd Harriman, 57 years old, disappeared July 12, 2001, as well as the disappearance of Teresa Vangus, 16 years old, disappeared October 31st, 2006, and with the murder of Sarah Trusty, 23 years old, July 12th, 2002. Since then, there have been no more disappearances and no further murders. The only solid conviction that has ever been made in the connection to these Killing Fields happened in 2012. And it was concerning the murder case of Miss Crystal Baker. The breakthrough in this instance came back in 2009 when an evidence officer for Chambers County named Sherry Wilcox resubmitted Crystal's dress as evidence in order to subject it to a more modern DNA testing. Well, as fate would have it, it worked. A DNA match was found for a man that had been arrested for a completely unrelated drug charge. His name? Kevin Edison Smith. Who then, later on, of course, under questioning, admitted to killing her. And in 2012, he was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of Crystal Baker, marking this the only time DNA evidence has conclusively solved one of the killing field cases. Now, indeed, of course, there is, other than this, nothing but tenuous evidence, false confessions, cold trails, dead ends, and suspects without enough evidence to charge. Remember Tim Miller? Well, he would start the tradition of setting up crosses to mark the places where these victims were found. He would set them up for everyone. He set them up for Heidi, who disappeared while hitchhiking, of course, to see her friend, her boyfriend in Houston. There was also two more victims who were never identified, and he set crosses there also. These crosses simply read Jane Doe and Janet Doe. Mr. Miller went so far as he started his own missing persons search. It's called Texas EquiSearch. This group uses searchers on horseback, vehicles, and even helicopters to try to find people who have vanished. Skip Hollinsworth is a reporter for a magazine here in Texas called Texas Monthly. And in 1999, he interviewed Tim and did a great segment. In closing, here's some of Skip's quotes. "It's become this kind of ghost story for South Texas. For these parents, this mystery is not just a ghost story. It is a horrible reality." When speaking of the killing fields, Skip had this to say. "It's a kind of environment that's sultry and sinister. Easy to get to. You jump off I-45. You drive down one of the dirt rutted roads. You dump the body, and you're gone for good. Of all the dumping grounds around this country that there have been, this is about, for a serial killer, as good a place as they come."
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. So how many people in total were killed?
30.
Okay, man, that is a lot. Right?
Some of them can be attributed to it. Some of them cannot. You know, some of them have been around there. But we know that for a fact it was, well, let's say over 30. We'll say that.
And that's all that they know of.
That they know of for sure. Yeah, that's in those areas.
Right. So, I mean, there's active serial killers going on today. How many of these are never found, the bodies I'm talking about? Just people go missing. I mean, even the David Politis books point out that, I mean, there are far more missing people than you would think. Well, that aren't even kept up with.
Yeah, I read a lot of stuff about this, of course, and reading into this thing. And the funny thing about it is I've heard about this as a young man. This is one of those things, you know, you always hear these strange tales from different parts of Texas, just like most everybody that has, you know, the state you live in, you always hear these strange tales. This has been something that I've heard of off and on for several years of my life. And at one point I heard it was a trucker. They said it was a trucker because of the way it was, is that they could dump bodies. But the problem with that being is most of the time what they believe when a trucker is doing as a serial killer, there's these bodies that are dumped that aren't from this area. There's more and more Jane Does, you know, that they can't find where these people come from. These people aren't, they just don't know. This all seems to be taking place from somebody that was hunting in an area he was comfortable in. And when you listen to what the profiler talked about, when you listen to what they were describing, even though Robert Abel never, they couldn't find anything to tie him to Laura's case. You know, her dad was probably, you know, Tim's a little overzealous, but he had every right to be, and all this, because, you know, like we said, lots of times your gut instincts, your best instinct, it almost feels like, because of course he kills himself in 2005, but it was around that time is when all the killings stopped. No more disappearances, no more killings. I don't know if maybe he let's just, for argument's sake, devil's advocate right quick, let's just say it was Robert Abel.
Right, okay.
They couldn't tie him to it. Let's just say it was. Did he get too old to do this anymore? Did he almost get caught, and then the grief and everything he done, did it finally set in on him? They talk about it, you know, he and his wife were divorced. They got divorced. I mean, through all of this stuff, like, his life went into shambles. Did it finally start weighing on him? Because for years he may have gotten away with it.
Right. Yeah.
And then when it finally started weighing on him, and then he couldn't take it anymore and kill himself, you know, because you're talking about somebody that would have to be intelligent, very intelligent to get away with it, much like what they discuss when they talk. Now, look, Henry Lee Lucas has, you know, one of the serial killers. He's tried to confess to all this stuff. You get a lot of these guys that are already on death row
that make it up, right?
Well, they do it. Yeah, almost do it to try to, like, take the heat off of the real killer. Like, we're part of a club. I kill a bunch of people. You kill a bunch of people. I'll take your heat so you can continue hunting. You know, it's almost like this good old boy club of serial killers. The reason, though, that it almost feels like it was Robert Abel is just by how it all played out. It just so happens he fits that profile that the profiler came up with. He has the land adjoining to it. He'd lived down there for years and years, and he's extremely intelligent. So you're kind of like, man, what if he was just a great liar? You know what I'm saying? What if he was one of those dudes that he is a great liar? He covered all of his tracks. Maybe he never brought him back home. Maybe he had another place that the cops never found that where he took him.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, you don't know, but it's just odd that it stops. And usually, like what we've covered before, when it stops, there's one of two things stops. Either the real killer is dead or in jail. That's the only thing that stops them, because they don't just stop because they want to.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It just doesn't happen like that. So that's almost the way it is. So I've been wanting to talk about this for a while and do this one for a while, and I couldn't think of any better time to do it than now during Halloween, because to me, it's still, as much as we've discussed and the crazy creatures we cover and the black-eyed kids and all that, there's nothing more terrifying than a very evil human being.
I agree. I couldn't agree more.
There's nothing more terrifying, because you give them, when they decide they want to hunt, when they decide they want to start patterning you, and they start, it's one of those things that, what's more terrifying than a serial killer? There's not one. Especially people, you know, we always talk about like Ted Bundy things, a very a handsome, smooth talker.
Yeah.
The next thing you know, boom. But this one right here, it kind of kills me, because it's so many young girls, some very young girls that, look, it's one thing if you want to take out grown men, you know.
Right, tragic.
Exactly, but when you start talking about girls, they didn't stand a chance.
They know that young girls are weak, so that's exactly. They predate on them.
You're right.
And that's exactly why. I have to talk a minute before about our sponsor, Gaia.com. If you're into ancient history, which most of you are, there's a really cool series on there I've been watching called Hidden Origins with Michael Tellinger.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got over 24 episodes of this, and they vary from pyramids and stone circles to the pineal gland, Adam's calendar and the birthplace of humanity, stone circles in South America and South Africa, out-of-place artifacts and anomalies. All kinds of things. Now, I recently watched one this weekend called Anunnaki and South African Gold, and it is pretty awesome. So I really enjoyed it. Let's take a listen to this preview.
Hello, this is Michael Tellinger, and we continue our exploration into the ancient past, the murky origins of humankind and our species on this planet.
Why were these ancient people so obsessed with gold? Is there evidence of vast gold mining activities, especially in Southern Africa? Of course there is. Let's unravel these ancient mysteries in my new series called Hidden Origins, only on Gaia.
There you go. Michael Tellinger is an interesting guy. I've got a couple of his books, and I need to have him on. I think I could hook that up with Inner Tradition Books. He wrote a book that they sent us about these stone circles in Africa, and they are really cool. And Adam's calendar. Very, very interesting. So I suggest, if you're really into ancient history and stuff like that, also, you know, conspiracy theories, as well as yoga, transformation stuff, and just documentaries, Gaia.com is pretty cool. Cam, you said you were watching something.
I got drawn into conspiracy theories, and the reason I got pulled into this one was simply because our buddy, our grandpa, if you will, Jim Mars is on one. There's a little over an hour documentary that Jim's on called Ancient Aliens and the New World Order. And, of course, like we always talk about, Jim's about 30 minutes from us right now.
Yeah, man.
And we keep saying we're going to get him in here. We're going to have to break down and bring him in here.
Because
he's not getting
any
younger.
No, he's not.
But the stuff he covers gives me the willies. I'm not even going to lie. So I like, but if you want to go down the conspiracy trail and get deep, that's a great show.
And that is cool. Don't forget, if you'd like to share a story with Expanded Perspectives, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Or if you'd like to send a story for Unusual Encounters, we're about to start that again because we have the new supercomputer built.
JPL finished it. It's in my hands.
Make sure you title the email in all caps, Unusual Encounters, and we would perhaps share that on there. And if you're not familiar with what Unusual Encounters, that is a YouTube-only show that we started. Of course, we've only done one episode, but you can go over there and watch it. And then you can actually see our face along with our silky voices, right? Yeah, not that you want to, but it would be perfect for Halloween if you really want to scare yourself.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, for all you people out there with little trick-or-treaters, please be careful. Get them some glow sticks, flashlights. Make sure you hold their hand or they got a big brother or big sister helping them out. And for you adults, if you're going to another party, I know I mentioned it on the Elite Show, please be careful. Get a designated driver. We don't want to ruin the holiday season with doing something stupid like getting a DWI, right? Those things can be quite costly.
And make sure you take care of one another. Look out for each other's kids. Look out for one another. Let's all take care of each other on this flying convertible spaceship we call planet Earth.
Yeah, and please don't scare the little ones too bad. I mean, you don't want to give nobody no nightmares. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just have a little fun.
Have fun. Well, for you Elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you next Monday. For Inner Traditions, Anomalous Books, Ancient American Magazine, Pretty Lights, The Black Angels, and Gaia.com. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.